Welcome, everybody. I feel so godlike. Wow. This is Trends in Publishing. You know, we used to call this New Trends in Publishing. I hope that didn't still say that. I think we just changed it to Trends in Publishing because increasingly the newest trends are doing it the old way. But we'll talk about that. And there are things that are quite different, too. I am Jeffrey Leppendorf. I am the executive director of CLMP, the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses. For those of you who don't know CLMP, please check out clmp.org. But we are the national service organization, the helping organization for small literary publishers. That's lit mags, small presses, chapbook publishers, zines, online publishers. And part of the work we do is to have our folks work along with their very supportive colleagues in the larger publishing ecosystem. We're all part of the big publishing ecosystem, and we are going to have a chat today with some really fantastic people. This is quite a fabulous panel, and in doing so, we're going to speak about publishing in general, although I will admonish the panel that whenever possible, we do want to try to focus things toward literature of the type that many of you out there are probably writing. So, without further ado, we'll just start at the end. What I'm going to ask, I'm going to just have each of our panelists. I have a pet peeve about reading bios. I refuse to do it. So, I am going to ask each panelist in turn, starting with Johnny, to introduce themselves and, in no more than two large breaths, explain yourself. Tell us where you are and what you do there.
My name is Johnny Diamond. I'm the editor of Literary Hub, lithub.com, which is a website devoted to books, literature, and writers, and bookstores, and all things literary.
Wow. That's a tall order, Katie.
I'm going to ignore it. Sorry. My name is Katie Freeman, and I work at Riverhead Books, which is an innovative imprint of Penguin Random House. I'm also getting a master's in arts administration from CUNY. And I additionally work with a number of different literary nonprofits, including Penn, Libraries Without Borders, Community Word Project, Narrative 4, the National Book Foundation. If you have questions about any of those, please ask me. And you can find me online at Foxy Hedgehog.
My name is Dawn Davis. I am the publisher of 37 Inc., a literary imprint within the Atria group of Simon & Schuster. And for 13 years, I was the editorial director and publisher of Amistad, the imprint of HarperCollins dedicated to literature from the Black Diaspora.
In case you haven't noticed, I am also Johnny Diamond. my name is Michael Reynolds. I'm the editor-in-chief of Europa Editions, an independent press based in New York.
There's only one good breath. So I have to take a breather. My name is Porter Henderson. I'm editor-in-chief of Publishing Perspectives. We are the news medium of Frankfurt Book Fair, and our purpose is to cover the international trade book industry. All of my work as a journalist is done in publishing. I am formerly with CNN, The Village Voice, and Dallas Times Herald.
Welcome, everybody. I am going to start with a few questions just to get us going. Our goal is to have a chat amongst ourselves that you get to eavesdrop in on, and then you can join in pretty soon after. We're largely going to respond to questions. I will say this now, I might repeat it. I'm going to ask that questions be kept, one, to questions, and that these questions be concise enough. I know, how funny at a conference like this. That questions be concise enough for me to repeat them so that they can end up on the recording. What you say out there is not being captured in these microphones, and we need that. Also, you probably know, being in an audience like this, if someone in back of you asks a question or in front of you, you don't hear it, only we hear it. So I'm going to repeat them, so make it something I can repeat, please. Okay, so in no particular order, I jotted down a few starter questions to get us going. And Michael, I'm going to start with you. So Europa Editions started in 2005 and came out of Italy. Mm-hmm. And so it has its roots in Europe, which makes it a little unique for an American literary small press. And you publish a great deal in translation. So a couple of questions. You can answer either or both. One is, do you feel that coming out of Europe has provided a different way of going about publishing, or even just a, clearly some unique perspective, but how that might affect things that might have you operating differently than some of your colleagues. And I'm also just curious, given the current held ban, but the current situation with six countries, has this climate affected plans for your upcoming catalog in any way, or any of your translators?
Interesting questions. To answer the first question first, I think that there are many, many ways that coming out of Italy, the company is owned by an Italian couple who also own a small publishing house in Italy. And I think the connection with Italy and with Europe in general has had a huge influence on the way that we publish, down to things like you know, publishing works in translation. There was nothing unusual about that. We didn't feel that we were being revolutionary. It was only when we started publishing books here that people said, "Well, that's extraordinary, you do works in translation." Well, yes, we do, because that's just sort of the way that one publishes in Europe. And you know, down to doing trade paperback originals, to the fact that within the publishing house we all speak and read in different languages. The idea, I think, and probably this is more one of the more important things, that a publisher has a personality and is engaged in a conversation with the culture around it, and with readers, with booksellers, with reviewers. There's a personality, a perspective, an editorial idea behind the publishing house. In many bookstores in Europe, books are organized not alphabetically by author, but by publisher, because a reader would go in and say, I'm looking for this kind of book. I know that this publisher publishes.
Right. So do you think in Europe there's a greater sense of general readers having a feel for the sensibility of an imprint?
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's changing a little bit, unfortunately, but I think that is true. And you know, down to the fact that we try to create a uniform visual identity for our books, and you know, we're looking to acquire a certain kind of book because that book and that way of publishing fits into what we think of as being our mandate as publishers, our bailiwick, if you will. I was planning to bring out an Algerian author in the fall. He has more trouble in Algeria than he's likely to have in the United States. Our authors and our translators, we have a Turkish author in jail at the moment. None of this really answers your question. You are asking specifically about the travel ban.
Well, actually, it's really, how does world events affect publishing work and translation?
I mean, I think we, more than ever, we need to be porous entities. Yeah, we can't just sort of go. You know, I don't think we're a publisher of fiction. We're not about to all of a sudden start publishing hard hitting nonfiction. That's not what I'm saying, but it's certainly current events make us think more about why we are publishers of fiction. What is it about the literary fiction that we do publish that is important in the current conversation? And do we need to provide more context? Do we need to frame our publishing program differently in order to sort of get the message across more forcefully in this moment?
And I think that might really be what, when we get to trends, that might really be part of the crux of it, which is to say that I know we all believe in the power of literature, let's just speak about fiction for now, that to simply publish a work from another culture is in many ways a political act. It doesn't matter, that work itself doesn't need to be journalistic or overtly political.
Of course, yeah.
It's mere existence.
I mean, I think certainly with the idea of literary fiction, that we all know that fiction in general, reading fiction, is good for our capacity for empathy, and I think a publishing program can think about sort of social empathy and global empathy and extending the idea of sort of you know, being able to relate to a single individual, to being able to relate to a culture and identify to a certain point with a culture, with a school of thought, with a school of literature, with a particular, you know, this opens up onto other things. We tend to publish books that are that have been successful in their native markets. We're not publishing very experimental, very literary works. They tend to be works for general readers. And that, for us, is an important thing as well, because we don't feel that we're necessarily only connecting a writer with a readership here in the United States, but we're connecting readerships. We're creating a common experience between readerships in different countries.
Yeah, I think we're going to hear from two folks from larger commercial houses, but I think this idea of global empathy might be something we'll be hearing more about. That might be the first time I've heard that term, but it's something we'll be hearing more about. So, hashtag that global empathy, kids. That we might be thinking more, that as publishers at least, thinking more about that, that what it means to publish some of these works beyond the fact that it's a great book, you know, and other people in another country got to enjoy it, and why not folks here? I in the past heard a colleague who was actually an agent, actually a scout, for, you know, looking at books in other countries, saying that they hated the term works in translation. She used to say, why is translation a genre?
Yeah.
And it seems from what you're saying that in other countries, it's not a genre,
not so
they're
much.
Just books.
Yeah. Yeah.
They may be from another language originally, but they're just books. But here we have this growing genre, wonderfully, of works in translation, but it's something we all as Americans think about a little more now, perhaps, than before. And we might be seeing more of that, which is terrific. I'm going to jump to Dawn. The idea of the sensibility question is one that I want to kind of carry over to you, because you are at an imprint within a publishing group within a publishing conglomerate. So just to back up, so when you started Amistad, that itself, I believe Amistad had originally been an independent press.
Correct.
And I'm not going to say I believe, because I know this, I did my research. It was founded the same year as CLMP, 1967. That was a rather remarkable thing, African-American.
Not founded by me.
No. No, because she was three. or one. we do sometimes find that, you know, small presses do sometimes then become part of a larger entity. And you were at Amistad for a while, which was HarperCollins, and then you moved to Simon & Schuster, and you are the founder, I think.
Correct.
Yes, of 37 Inc. So first just tell us a bit about 37 Inc. and what it as an imprint, what is your publishing mission, sensibility? How would you describe it?
So 37 Inc., when I left Amistad, I decided to, which was dedicated to works about the Black diaspora, I had an opportunity to create an imprint within Atria. So as he said, an imprint is a sensibility. And what I wanted to do was have an imprint where Black culture wasn't necessarily marginalized, it was part of the whole. So I publish works from around the globe, and I wanted to do that specifically so that it wasn't, Black books were on the outside of the center, that we are part of the center. We're in dialogue with the rest of the what's going on globally. I feel that Black culture has so much influence on the rest of global culture that it made sense to kind of have a publishing program that was integrated.
So I'm curious, I think for the sake of folks here who may not really know how some of this works, I'm gonna ask you two questions.
Sure.
But the first one is a more basic how publishing works question. And Katie, you could jump in on this too if you want, because you're also at an imprint that has a really clearly defined sensibility. Was that Katie's at Penguin Riverhead, very, very literary imprint. So for either of you really, you could speak simultaneously if you're of one mind. could you just tell us how it is that imprints work within a larger house? What sort of autonomy do they or do they not have? At what point do things have to go higher up the chain, or at what point do you get to say, I'm publishing this?
So I could just give an example. We both get submissions from agents, and the agents try to match the proposal, the novel, nonfiction narrative to the editor's sensibility. So they know that I'm interested in literary fiction, literary narrative nonfiction. If I like it, I may also be in competition with other imprints. There are several at Simon, and there are many more, like Katie talked about, where she works. And we all get to make a play with the agent and with the author, why we think you're the appropriate editor for this book. And ultimately, it comes down to money, and also direction. What is the editor's vision for the book? And the author usually picks an editor based on those two things. Now, if I'm
you know, several tens of thousands of dollars lower, I'm going to lose no matter what. But in close competition financially, the editor, the author, and the agent will respond on what direction do I give in terms of shaping the novel, and what do I see as the marketing vision once it's at market.
And but before I bring Katie in, let me just ask you, do you ever have the situation of bidding between imprints within the house?
Yeah, just yesterday, actually, I found out that I prevailed in an auction for a biography of August Wilson by a theater critic from the Boston Globe. And I think she responded because I love August Wilson. I was literally able to pick out, you know, my ticket. I just seen Jitney on Broadway, which is amazing. If you want to talk about the language of the Black vernacular coming to just crisp formation in that play, it's superb. And I was able to bring a kind of authentic passion for the project.
So yeah, it's a relationship.
It's a relationship.
So Katie, let me ask you, because you do publicity at Riverhead, and I will say that, you know, I'm a professional small press fan. I'm also a genuine small press fan, but to me, Riverhead books are like a small press. You know, I think of it, it's so clearly defined, you know, for me as a reader. But let me ask you, as a publicist, do you have interaction with the publicity teams of the other imprints at Penguin?
That's an interesting question. We don't as much. And I'm going to answer the question you asked previously with a metaphor that I've often tried to use to explain publishing to people outside of publishing. It's really unclear whether it works. And it's also not, like, don't be too defined about it. But it's this. It's as if an imprint is an apartment building, and then we're part of a publishing group, so that's like the floor of the apartment building, and then we're part of a larger company, in my case Penguin Random House, which is kind of like the landlord of that building, and in turn we're owned by someone beyond that, which again in our case is Bertelsmann, which is a German company, and partially by Penguin. Thank you. Pearson, who owns Penguin. It's really confusing. It gives you like a square, you know, in your mind. And so Riverhead is a very small imprint within that extremely large, Penguin Random House is the biggest publisher in the world. Riverhead only publishes about 3 dozen books a year, which is not a lot for a corporate publisher. And we are our identity is very defined. And you didn't ask about this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway,
please.
Which is one of the trends when we're thinking about literary trends that I see, it has been with the advent of the internet and social media, the real rise of identities of small presses and of presses in general, but particularly small presses. Riverhead operates like a small press in those ways. We have a very large presence on social media, on Snapchat and Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook, Twitter, every place, and it's very clear the kinds of things that we publish, even though we publish a lot of different things within that identity. And I think I'm a big fan of small presses as well, and indie presses, and I love seeing the ways in which they've been able to use social media and the internet to create that identity and really get themselves known in the world and have readers. And I wanted to ask a really quick question, which is, if you all think of the last book that you read or the book that you're reading right now, how many of you could say off the top of your head who published that book?
Thank you so much for asking that. That's probably pretty good, and I wonder if that's because, I'm not going to bother asking, it would be silly, because so many of you are probably writers. Maybe you're a little more aware of the imprints, but I think people do have a growing awareness, and it is because of the work of folks like you, and that actually was my next question, which is a thing that has changed, is that it used to be, in general, that from the larger houses at least, were mostly concerned about unit sales and not really who individual readers were, right? And that has been we don't have to argue about it, it's been a trend over the past few years that you do care who they are, and you're able to, in fact, communicate with them directly through social media, which is really different.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to ask a general social media question, because now we have more, you know, the tyranny of data, that even though there's growing social media presence of all publishers of various kinds, do you find there is a direct connection between social media presence of, let's talk about a book, and its sales, or is it doing something else?
Can you ask that question? question.
Yeah, is there a correlation between number of retweets and hits and unit sales, to be gross about it?
It absolutely depends. It depends on the book, and it depends on how you're using social media for that particular book and whether or not the author is participating. Out of curiosity, just because I'm going to ask another question that y'all work again, how many of you are on social media? And just how many are you on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and Tumblr? How many of you knew what all of those were? it absolutely depends, because social media is not something it's actually not that easy to do. It does require some thought. It requires some concept of what it is that you want to achieve and how you want to communicate and being part of a conversation. And it's also not something that, for authors, they'll say, okay, my book's coming out in a month, so I'm going to hop on social media. That's really not how it works. It requires more forethought and more investment and a long-term commitment to the form, and those forms are different. So Twitter operates differently than Facebook does. So it's hard to answer that question about what effect it has, because everyone uses it in a different way and every book uses it in a different way. But to give one really quick example, last year we published a book by Garrett Conley called Boy Erased, which is a memoir of his time in he went through gay conversion therapy or ex-gay therapy. And social media has offered a way for readers to really find him about a book that is about a really intimate subject and about something that's very important to a lot of them. So it's been fascinating seeing the ways in which they've been able to find and communicate with him directly in really life-affirming ways.
And as a publicist, would you say that, either due to social media or other things, but I would think social media in particular, that the way that you work with an author when publicizing their book might have changed or be changing?
Yeah, again, it depends on who the author is. It also means now that an author and I can communicate through direct messages on Twitter and Facebook messages, and they can snap things to me. So everything, our attention is all fractured. And that goes for publicity as well, which is not a question that you asked, but a question that I'll answer. And a thing that has changed in the work that I do. So I've been a publicist for 15 years. In the beginning, that meant that we were concentrated often mainly on getting reviews in the two dozen places that were running reviews. A lot of places don't even run reviews anymore. There's so many books being published. There's little space for those books to be covered, so we have to be creative, which is interesting and allows us to be innovative and invigorating about how we're getting our books out into the world. But it also, it also offers some challenges, because the landscape is more, it's more fragmented, it's more fractured around where people are finding information about books.
I just want to back up a moment. I want to actually sort of go back to that, and then we'll bring Johnny in. But I'm just curious to ask Dawn, back to how imprints interact or don't. So very recently, within Simon & Schuster, we had a little debacle with Roxane Gay. Did that have anything to do with you in any way, or was it just over there within Simon & Schuster?
It was just over there. Of course I'm affected by it. I'm affected by the controversy. But one of the things that I was able to say is to any author who asks, is that this is what my imprint stands for. These are the books that I've been publishing within this imprint, and indeed for the past 20 years. And so you can see, again, the sensibility is different. And for most people, that was enough.
Yeah, so we do have the situation where in a very large house, of the five, that you can have imprints where they can diverge politically tremendously.
Absolutely.
And they can all be absorbed under the larger imprint.
Exactly.
The larger house.
And even in terms of literary sensibility, you can diverge. You can have some imprints that really excel at publishing what we call commercial women's fiction. You can have some, Adria has had some success with literature in translation, if you will. And you can have some imprints that do better with, quote, ethnic fiction. So even within the literary spheres, imprints can distinguish themselves.
Right, so it's just an interesting phenomenon. We're going to move it back now to what Katie, you were bringing up, and we'll bring Johnny in. You're talking about we have new spaces now. As a lot of traditional review venues have in fact gone away, there are other kinds of spaces where books can get attention, and one is LitHub. So Johnny, why don't you just give, for those who here subscribes to LitHub?
Subscribes to what?
LitHub, the literary hub. So not everybody. So why don't you give us a little, that's shocking.
Good, actually.
No, that's great. That's a lot. If you folks represent everybody, then that is amazing. But for those who don't know, why don't you just tell us a little bit about when it started, what it is, and then we can dig a little deeper.
Well, as I mentioned in my introduction, Literary Hub is a website devoted to books, writers, bookstores, and literature in general. We will be 2 years old in April. We launched at AWP 2 years ago in Minneapolis. And we work with a wide range of literary entities across the internet, from large imprints, big publishing houses, to very, very tiny journals run by one person, to nonprofits. And basically our goal is to gather in one place what we think of as the best, most interesting, valuable essays, features, thoughts, interviews to do with contemporary literature in America and around the world. That's sort of
right. And you both aggregate stuff out there, and you also have original content.
Yes, we're about 40-60 now in terms of so-called aggregation. I don't like, as an editor, the word aggregation because it's sort of...
You curate.
I'll say curate. Yeah. For curate. Aggregation suggests a kind of algorithmic system that we have, which we don't. We just have people reading things. And then we have a freelance budget, and we like to obviously assign stories, and we work with writers, and we work with publicists in terms of books that they have coming out to figure out the best way to talk about books and get more books into people's hands. That's the basic.
Right, and this may seem like a silly question, but if you had to define who this is for, how might you define that?
Well, before we launched, we tried to be very specific about who we thought of as our core readership. And so we started with booksellers as one core readership, representing what we think of as an amazing resource in terms of literature in this country. The people who are reading the most, talking the most about books, and really, I'm sure you guys will agree, booksellers, when booksellers get their hands on a book that they love and start talking about it, that can really affect sales and can really kind of get good material into readers' hands. So booksellers is one constituency. And then MFA programs and the broader community around MFAs in this country represents a massive, very engaged, very interested readership. And so that was another group we thought of. Industry professionals is another group that we thought of in terms of what will the story do in terms of readership. And then last but not least, the few remaining people in this country who buy books but don't think they have a book in them to write, which I'm not sure how big that number is. But that would be...
They're both very nice.
They're both very nice, yes.
So if you know, I'm just curious. So your readership has been growing.
Yes.
Do you feel like there's been a trend or shift in who is reading you in terms of, let's call them insiders or outsiders?
Well, insiders and outsiders is I hate to say this, but it's a ridiculously subjective set of...
Well, let's say industry insiders.
Less so industry, and I do think more... I don't know, it's a broad generalization, but as I said, the broader MFA community, you can take that for what that means. That's working writers and teachers, obviously students, aspiring writers at all levels. I think that represents a large portion of our audience. In terms of the way readership has changed, I do think that we are still growing within our core targets of readership. We have started broadening our coverage a little bit, a bit more into crime fiction and sort of testing the waters in that direction, but yeah.
And clearly anyone that loves, like me, reading the Lit Hub Daily knows that you do an amazing job of responding to world events, you know, right away. But I wanted to ask, in a larger sense, are there any general trends of what people have been writing about having to do with the industry or literature in general that you've just seen over the past, well, since you've been doing it?
Well, in terms of the most specific trend, which trend is a facile way of talking about it, but it's impossible in this moment for writers to not be writing with politics at the foreground of everything they're thinking about. And we encourage that, and I think, you know, we made a very hasty, panicked, sad decision on November 9th that to really push and to add a layer of politics on top of a literary site, because we find the distinction between the two completely ridiculous. And so we have sought to give platform to writers to engage politically. Whose line is it that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world? Is it Shelley? Anyone?
Shelley.
And so we seek to acknowledge them as much as possible and to kind of provide, again, a platform for some kind of moral center
No, I mean, I think I've been seeing that. It's been nice. Let me ask you about one more thing. There's one kind of cool feature on the site, the bookmarks.
Oh, bookmarks, yes.
Just tell us what that is, and
a
question about it.
Was conceived of, perhaps poorly initially, as a Rotten Tomatoes for books. And the goal with bookmarks is to actually aggregate, in the mathematical sense, all of the daily book reviews from professional critics from around the country, so that when you want to figure out who's saying what about a book, you can go and see the book, click on the book, and you can see all the reviews about the book. And that is, in a nutshell, bookmarks. The goal behind bookmarks, rather than to create frustrating hierarchies of books and writers, is to actually shine a light on the ongoing value of criticism, literary criticism in this country. And I think if you play around on that a little bit, it is pretty addictive to just see who's saying what, and you can go to critics and see everything they've reviewed in the past, and can kind of just lose yourself in terms of that.
Yeah, and that way a critic operates like a press sensibility. You know, you can get to know a critic, and then mm-hmm. you can filter what
right,
they're
exactly.
saying. Let me ask you this, though, because I would just say I've heard some grumbles from some small presses.
Grumbles,
yeah, I know.
Fury. Fury.
That's a euphemism for fury, which is that, you know, there's a tyranny of algorithms, as you have already hinted, which is that there's something automatic about them, mm-hmm. and that you set up a formula, and it's tyrannical. You know, it doesn't necessarily always make certain wise choices that we might make if we could stand outside of it. And so in this case, it's drawing from sources mm-hmm. that already filter what they might review. And so particularly for some smaller publishers, particularly those focusing on work in translation, for example, might not always show up in certain reviews. And to be fair, there is a huge number of books put out every year. Someone might have that number handy, but it's an enormous number of books.
It's lots and lots of books.
The total number of books
put out a year. Let's say literary.
It's a giant
number. And so and there are various ways we could measure it and what kind of books we're counting and all of that. But it doesn't matter. Even if we take the smallest possible number any of us could come up with, it is more books than reviewers could be reviewing. That's sort of a human fact. And so the challenge is, and I'm not criticizing bookmarks at all in this way, but I'm just saying, how do we address this challenge of how might we, and this, Katie, you can ask this too as a publicist, you know, how do we shine lights on those books which would not naturally be reviewed because of where they come from or what they are or who their publicist is? How do we solve that challenge? Is there a solution or is it just really hard? Porter's going to jump in on that one.
I'm going to jump in on this. Hope I survive it. I think you're getting into a very important thing. And while I would like not to say that the threats to freedom of expression that we see today in the nationalist risings in so many countries, and indeed in Trumpian Washington, are a good thing, I think they do provide literary fiction with a very unusual opportunity to make its case, to frame itself and its importance to the world. Because I think that the way that literary fiction moves through our consciousness and through our nations and through our peoples, plural, is by giving us the kind of global empathy that Michael was talking about in a way that genre doesn't, because genre doesn't have to. I do have a couple of numbers of publications, and they're going to scare you to death. In 2015, self-publishers, we haven't even gotten, I'll get them, self-publishers, not traditional, alone published 625,327 books with ISBNs on them. You know ISBN, the International Identifier Number, right? We think that once you add the ones that do not have ISBNs on them, because they go through Amazon, which doesn't require them, we're looking at more than 1.5 million titles coming out every year from self-publishers, right? Now the great vast majority of that is genre, okay. Let's look for a moment very quickly. I'll only give you one more number at traditional. 15,000 titles. You know who puts that out? One publisher from our friend in the apartment building, the landlord, right? And the Random House. 15,000 books a year come from the biggest of the big five. And that's as far as we have to go because you're getting a picture. This is a gigantic wall of content, as I say, that we face. And at the very moment that we have this opportunity to start reaching through the freedom of expression importance that's happening, and to bring the work of literary fiction to bear on the many voices and diversity we want to get out of the world. Literary fiction is the weakest of the genres. I would like us to start calling it a genre. I would like us to give up our squeamishness about saying that just because, oh, we have so many things we deal with in literary. Too bad. We've got to call it something, right? Let's just call it literary and start advertising and promoting and pushing it. We need to get to our publishers and say, you have to do this. Because we just had the Digital Book World Conference in New York, the main annual conference of the industry here in this country every year. And literary was not discussed. I'm sorry to tell you.
So Porter, I had intended, he's going in exactly as planned, to report from Digital Book World, but I did not attend this year, but I've attended in past years, and it's always been frustrating to me, someone who represents literary publishing, that I feel like the giant, tiny world that I represent is barely mentioned there, if at all.
Yeah.
And that a lot of the data that we even read about, people reading more e-books, people reading less e-books, all of that, frequently has almost no relation to the publishing that I most care about.
That's right, and I, some of what I'm saying is going to sound jarring to you, I realize, but because I'm the journalist on the table, I work at a greater distance from the heart of literary than almost anyone in this room, I'm sure. And we all are in bubbles. I am in a journalistic bubble, understand that. I'm not throwing any stones here at glass bubbles, right? But because you all are working so close to it, I think it's hard for you to perceive how little attention the world at large is paying to literary, and I do not want to see the fact that it has no traction in digital mean that we lose it. This is a dangerous moment for us, and yet it is our greatest opportunity. Yeah.
Do you think, I'm going to go to questions in just a moment, but just staying with that, do you think, I guess the question is why that is, and do you think it's that the sort of writing that we're talking about in the most general sense probably requires more prolonged engagement, perhaps not the kinds of reading.
It does, but it's even simpler than that. We're at an age in human history, in human development, when we have a bigger impact coming in at us from entertainment than we've ever had before. The electronic media, which are giving us gaming and video and TV and music and film and everything, is just ridiculous, are so powerful and their reach is so deep into the consciousness of the industry. Let's face it, we all enjoyed a binge out on Netflix or something. I mean, there is some wonderful television being made now. Some of it quite literary on its basis. There is good material to be had, but because the power of the electronic media is so great, we're having a hard time, as for example, live stage theater has, fighting film and television now. We are about to become a museum art if we're not careful. And I don't think it's our fault, and yet it is our fault if we don't rise to it and begin to stake our claim and to say who we are and to push what we.
Thank you for that call to action. You know, we can have a, it's so wonderful being at AWP each year and having such a concentration of literary folk, but we can't forget that we are the minority out there and that we have to all stake our claim, even as individual readers, that what we care about is worth everyone caring about. I'm happy at this point to open it up, and I want to invite, as we take this first question, panelists to yank the mic from one another and converse about it and not have to be the sole answer of a question, and not everyone has to speak in answering a question either. So we had a question back there, and yes, and I'm going to repeat it. So.
My question is, are you finding that what would have been called literary fiction maybe 20 years ago is now being pushed into other genres? Because I've been told as a writer by everybody I ask never to call your writing literary fiction because there's quote no market for it. So we call it something.
Great question. So this question speaks to what Porter was just saying. I'll jump to the end. Is the term literary fiction a poisonous term for those trying to get published? And has, over the past 20 years or so, the very idea of literary fiction changed in its meaning and perhaps been pushed out into things called otherwise?
The safe term to use right now is commercial, I think. Maybe the rest of the table will say something else, but if you need in the door, try saying, oh, I'm writing commercial fiction.
Upmarket commercial fiction.
Upmarket even better.
Upmarket commercial fiction. I don't know. I mean, I think that we have a small publishing program and we do literary fiction. We also have a high-end crime fiction series, but most of what we do is literary fiction. So I'm probably less aware of those pressures than perhaps people at other imprints or
That said, I mean, I think we're all under this enormous and constant pressure to classify our books in a million different ways. And very often, genre classifications are, you know, they're the siren song, they call to us, yeah, and we, you know, are tempted to use some of those tags in order to, especially now that things are still, I think, moving into a digital platform increasingly, the question of metadata, how do you talk about your books online, what sort of information do you add to that, and the temptation is always to add a tag to a work of literary fiction that sort of, you know, romance as well, just put it out there and see what happens. Yeah, so that we do feel that pressure, even being a literary press.
Actually, John, let me ask you, because you're having books pitched at you all the time, have you found a shift in terms of what you might call, let's stick with fiction, literary fiction, how it's described? Is it euphemized to make it sound like it will sell more, or are you not aware of it?
I think someone mentioned this earlier, we have so many, because of social media, we have to constantly feed copy, come up with hashtags, and constantly find new ways of describing novels. I think the best thing to do is to let the work speak for itself. If you come from an MFA program, we're going to know that it's, quote, literary fiction. There's no need to tag it. But we do constantly shift women's fiction, upscale women's fiction, independent fiction. I don't necessarily avoid literary fiction because we all know it when we think we see it. And when you go into your publisher, you want to be very candid about what it is you're trying to buy. Short stories are short stories. They're difficult to sell. They win your heart. And we still buy them. So I think the answer is yes and no.
Right. So it's not that, for writers out there, it's not that they should avoid using certain terms. Should they?
Certainly not for Riverhead.
Right.
For other places, possibly. But at Riverhead, you know, we believe in publishing such a diverse group of authors and types of books, because we think there's really real power in that. I mean, a couple of years ago, we published an 800-page book that's written with 76 different characters and several different types of vernacular and languages. That book was Marlon James's A Brief History of Seven Killings. It went on to win the Booker Prize, and it has sold a lot of copies. But we published it because we believe that book had a lot of power and deserved to be present in the world and represented. And, you know, when you talked about, I'm really sorry also, I took a 3 a.m. train and my capacity for sentences is decreasing, but I made it before the snow. When you asked about how many books we want to sell, I mean, obviously, do I want people to read many, many thousands and millions of copies of Riverhead books? I do. But I also believe that part of the power of the books that we're publishing, and we were talking about literary fiction, narrative nonfiction, poetry, you know, all of the things that AWP is celebrating, we're talking about books that have the power to change people's lives. And that might not mean that, you know, 2 million people are sitting down to read the same book. It could mean that, absolutely. But it also may mean that it reaches 3,000 people and that it really has a deep and lasting impact on their lives. And I celebrate books that do all of those things. So
yeah, and I'll say too, you know, I'm the shared executive director with Small Press Distribution, which is the nation's only nonprofit book distributor. Most of our books are in rather tiny print runs. Some of them do sell many thousands of copies, but if they do, it's usually over a number of years. So, you know, part of the beauty of literature is that, I'll just say boldly, you know, when you read a book, you become part of the community of readers, but not necessarily at the same time. You know, you might join in with someone who read a book 100 years ago. You're still part of that community. Who's affected by it. That's what's wonderful.
Absolutely. So I guess when I talk, you know, we're talking about literary fiction, it's not necessarily, again, that I want our books to sell as many as they can, because I believe very much in them, and I want them to reach as many people as possible. But I'm more concerned, industry-wise, when you talk about trends, about those kinds of books being read generally more by more people, and about accessibility. The National Book Foundation just piloted a program where they're going to be, it's something like 200,000 or 300,000 books that they're taking into what they're calling book deserts in the U.S., which are places where people are not having access to literature and not having access to books. They're partnering with a lot of public housing places and getting books into those spaces. But there's a lot of places where, you know, our libraries matter, our bookstores matter, supporting our indie bookstores matter, like making sure that you're buying in your community, but buying books from wherever you can too, but supporting your libraries. Like, my concern is about, for Riverhead, is about publishing books that, that we believe should be in the world, and my concern as a literary citizen in the world is that we support the institutions and the places that make it possible for you to get these books, so that the readership for literary fiction, narrative nonfiction, poetry increases as a whole, and that we all have access to those kinds of works.
And you know, just to stick on, speaking of like, say, the Marlon James book, or I'm thinking of some books that have just come out more recently. Sellout isn't so new, but we've been hearing more about it. Or the new Paul Auster book, which is, you know, a big one. Do you think there might be a growing appetite, as focused as it might be, for more difficult literary books?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly your attitude towards how you publish them. And I think, you know, Don, you too, your imprint and our imprint and the way that Literary Hub covers books, and certainly the way that Europa publishes them. I mean, we publish these books with verve and with pride. And, you know, and that can be really difficult, unusual books. We published a book called Sudden Death that just came out in paperback by Alvaro Enrique, who's a Mexican-American writer. I mean, it's a book about a Spanish poet and about conquistadors and, you know, world history. And it's told through a match about a tennis ball of Anne Boleyn's hair. I mean, it's an unusual book, but we found the readers for it. One thing that, when I was talking before about the fragmentation of the spaces in which you're able to find out about books, is that fragmentation means that you have to find different ways into how people are finding out about books. And again, you know, we use social media a lot for that, but also places. Lit Hub was a place where we announced a book by Mohsen Habib, his new novel called Exit West, which is set in an unnamed country and about refugees. And they, you know, did the jacket reveal in a conversation between Mohsen and John Freeman, and that's where we launched that book into the world, because we know people are coming to the site to find out about new fiction of the kind that we publish.
Thanks. We have a question back there, I promise, next. Right, so I'm gonna try to get a question there. Right, so the simple question is, for anyone on the panel, is the role of literature primarily escapist or enrichment? Does it need to be one or the other? And do we see a shift? I'm gonna add your question. Do we see a shift in it moving one way or the other? There's certainly, as you said, easier to consume and access forms of entertainment these days. And they're alluring and readily available. So, what does that leave us?
I like your question very much, and your thought is very good. I think there are two things going on there, and I think we try to sell and move and push this into the community both ways. I think that good literature is an escape. Certainly, I'm reading the Paul Auster myself, and We Get Lost is wonderful. And at the same time, the enrichment is amazing, and what you get from it as a person and as a mind of your own and in communion with the mind of the author is fantastic. There are those, however, who are not available to the idea of enrichment. They are available to the idea of a great story, of a good escape. And I think one of the things I've suggested to authors with whom I work in my daily stuff is to try to get them, when they publish a book, to bring me new readers for that book. I want them to walk around, thrust it into the hands of the banker friends, right? Your friends you're talking about, and personally ask them to read the thing. because when they feel that escape, then they start to understand. I think we have to do missionary work like that. It sounds ridiculous, and it sounds like the kind of thing most of us would not like to think of having to spend our time doing. We'd rather write the book than force it on somebody, but I think we need to force it on some people.
No, we do have to create ambassadors for books.
I think we do, and I think the reason I like your question is that until we start admitting that this disconnect is here and addressing it this clearly, and sometimes at such a ridiculously ground level, just walking around saying, here, this is something you need to read. Sit down and let me watch you read it. and when you're done, you will tell me, right? I think we're not going to make the kind of progress we need in that wider world.
It's interesting. I'm a working mom, and I have so many mommy friends who don't work, and they read all the time, and they read literary fiction. They're much better versed in it than I am, because after I get home, make dinner, wash the dishes, check homework, I don't have time to sit down and read a novel like I did before I had children. And so I actually do think that there's an audience that is hungry. They go to readings, they are in multiple book club groups, but Americans, we know, take less vacation than ever before. I do think that, you know, what we've seen happen politically also ties into the leisure time that we have to sit down and enjoy a really good novel. So yes, we need to thrust novels into people's hands and ask them to read, but we also need to, you know, tell them to take advantage of their 2 weeks vacation so that they can read. I mean, I think that they're connected is what I'm trying to say.
You know, it's funny, I have a lot of mommy fiction reader friends who have increased their reading after having a baby, and it's because they can hold an e-reader or phone in one hand while taking care of the child with the other. So we can get back to digital, but digital reading for high literary has actually been a great boon to moms with young kids. Katie, you had something to add?
Oh, I was just going to say really quickly, I mean, just to rearticulate as well about accessibility and about assumptions, that I just feel like education is such a big part of this about people feeling like reading is something that they want to do and that they can do and that they have access to being able to do it. And I also generally just think too that to assume everyone is a reader, but that sometimes a person hasn't found their first book and you are the person who's going to open the door into them finding that. And I think you see people, and certainly personally I've had experiences of people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s who have found the book that's right for them, and that opens up a world to finding more. And I think that's an incredible experience. There's a Kiese Lehmann, who's a writer, who's Simon Schuster has his new book, I think. But he published two books with a small press, one called Long Division, one called How to Kill Yourself Slowly in America. I feel like I'm almost right on this. He's a wonderful, passionate, fierce writer, and he tells a story about a teenager, a 15 or 16 year old young black man in Louisiana, who, I hope I'm getting the story right also, sorry Casey if I'm wrong, who came up to him at one of his readings and said, yours is the first book that I've ever read, and I loved it so much. And that opened the door for him, and it's just such a powerful thing, and that does mean being an evangelist for books and finding those new readers, but also just assume that everyone is or can be.
We'll go back there, and then we'll come up here. You'll be two, and we'll go one back there. With a hat.
All right.
And I'll try to, there's sort of a few questions in there. They're all good. So in terms of perhaps changing the hunger for reading, enhancing it, is it the writer's responsibility or the publisher's? And in either way, is the question changing the writing itself, or is it changing the way that we publish or the way that we reach these new readers? Does that kind of do it?
Basically, yeah.
Okay. Anyone want to take a stab at that simple question?
I think in the genre of literary fiction, that a publisher and an editor would be mistaken to suggest to an author that an author radically change something in order to reach an audience. I think it's problematic.
But it's tempting.
But it's sometimes tempting. It is certainly the publisher's job to take what that publisher has acquired, what the editor has acquired, and reinvent how they publish that book every single time, every single title, looking for those readers that Katie was just talking about. So yes, we do have to rethink and reinvent and do things differently. And that happens with every book. There are an infinite number of ways to find readership, and we have to decide when to abandon our efforts and how to sort of shape them.
Probably it's fair to say, particularly with literary fiction, as opposed to genre fiction, that every single book is an absolutely new project. Yeah. And you can't just do what you did with the last book. It may or may not work. It's the job, I think, of agents and editors to help a writer realize the very best final version of the writer's book, not to make them change it for a marketplace, if it's particularly literary fiction. It's then a publisher's job to, hopefully with some help from the writer, but it's a publisher's job to publish it, and publishing means to make public. So that is, in fact, what publishing is. Publishing is getting a literary work from an author to readers. That part is publishing. So how they do it is changing all the time, and it's a constant challenge, and I'm sure everyone here who's publishing is making new discoveries with every single book, and then those discoveries may not work with the next book. Anything to add along those lines?
Sounds
good. Even though I don't publish books, I'm going to jump in and suggest that we are perhaps risking something when we think of moral complexity in literary fiction as separate from telling a good story.
Yeah.
I think that while it's important for us to understand and be ambassadors for what we think of as literary, to not necessarily think of genre as quite such a passive engagement. Crime fiction is a marvelous atmosphere or environment for working on problems of good and evil, and what we do in extremis. I think it is wiser, perhaps, to think of it as a continuum rather than as two discrete categories. And I say that, from someone covering it, if you're a writer, if you're marketing it, it is a lot more fluid, I think, than the categories we use for, catalogs. So I think that's important.
Thank you for saying that. And in the same way, I will say, just to extend the idea of the continuum, there is the right kind of publisher for the right kind of literature. There, small presses and large houses are neither better nor worse. It's the right scale for the right kind of book. And in the same way that it's not that genre fiction is bad and what we're calling literary fiction is good. There are different genres, and many, many books, in fact, fall between the two. We were just talking about Paul Auster as the famous example. So. I'll just say, as a reader, I would hope that no author would change the way that they are writing their life, and they're using their lifeblood to write a book, thinking about the marketplace. I would hope you would just write the very best story or poem that is in you, and then leave it to professionals to help market it and publicize it and get it out there and put it into a package. But you should just be writing the very best book you can, and not worry about what people are buying this year. That would really be a shame. We have a question right here.
Porter, you were talking about the power of literary fiction and sort of your fear of losing that power as we move into the digital age. And I'm wondering what you think, what that power is versus genre fiction. Because when I think of genre fiction, I can think of something like speculative fiction or apocalyptic fiction, and it can very much speak to things that are going on right now for different communities. So I'm wondering what this literary fiction thing is that's separate from genre.
Right, so a question for Porter. Put you back
what
on the spot with this.
Doing?
Yeah, if we are to make a distinction between genre writing and what we're calling literary, capital L,
yeah,
literary fiction, in terms of how either one of these might speak to the world as we know it now, what might we have to say about those two things?
I like your question because it's one that I think all of us wrestle with quite a bit. And as Johnny is saying, we don't want to draw a wall between the two. We don't want to make these things two separate entities. That there is complete, it's a spectrum. There is complete fluidity there, as he's saying. One of the reasons that digital has been more successful in most of the genres as we normally refer to them, is because those genres have standing audiences. There are sci-fi readers whom you can identify much more easily than there are readers of the many subjects and topics and things going on in literary. There are romance readers. Boy, are there romance readers. And a part of their engagement is to be loyal and to read more and more and more. They make the voracious level of reading they do a point of pride, and that's great. It's wonderful for what they're doing. Literary doesn't come to such a standing ready audience, and its formulations are not so formulaic. In most of the genres, there are traditions and expected performances, certainly in romance. There are lines you don't cross. There are things you always make sure your heroine and your hero do, right? In literary, we're all over the place. That's one of the reasons it's so marvelous and can speak with such visceral impact to us. But you're absolutely right that apocalyptic work, of course, dystopian work is still very popular, even though it's starting to ease a little now, in the YA end especially. But these things are so powerful because they are touching us and because they're reaching into something of the experience of the world we're having. There's nothing wrong with that. Rather than damp down any of that, what I'm trying to say to the capital L literary world is let's go out and find that standing crowd that wants to think beyond an expected formula and get to them with all of the wide open spaces that we bring to the literary.
And of course, dystopian fiction today we just call CNN. Do we have another question? Yes. We are now going to reveal the secret. Well, no. So the question is, with all this fragmentation amongst media and even within literature, the different kinds of literature, etc., how does a book stand out? What can we do?
We were hoping you'd tell us.
Yeah. If we all knew that.
I'm just gonna say sometimes it's a slow burn. I mean, you talked about the seven killings. He's had, that wasn't his first book, right?
Yeah.
So he had to invest in his own career. Small publishers invested in his career. Critics invested in his career. I remember being on a panel with Nantes years ago. Some of the books that she's known for, she published three or four books by an author before the breakout book happened. So I think we really, all of us, have to look at the long road. I'm thinking of Ian McEwan. Before Atonement, he had published at least three other novels, maybe published 5,000 copies, she had said. And, don't quote me specifically, but she said if I'd given up, we would never have gotten to Atonement. So we really have to, it's not always what you see right away. Your first book may not be the standout book, but it says this is someone to watch, and we are all watching.
And I'll say even more so, we've done a lot of panels in the past with authors together with, editors and publishers and agents. It's very, very frequently the case, I don't know if it's most of the case, but it might even be, that an author's first published book is not the first book they wrote. So even there, it's, if you want to be a writer, you probably need to make a commitment to the long haul. And again, not be so worried about the marketplace. Write the best book you can. Lucky you, your first book hits, but, maybe it's your fifth book. There's no way to know. Even these professionals can't know. And, all publishing is a kind of form of venture capitalism. They're taking risk. They believe in it, you believe in it, you share that belief. Others may or may not.
I would, absolutely, first answer my message.
If it's not one thing, it's your mother.
It's about somebody discovering one of our books.
Someone just bought a copy of one of their books.
I get one of those every time. What Dawn and Jeffrey said that, the long view is really important for us as well. We've recently had this extraordinary success with an author by the name of Elena Ferrante. And
perhaps you've heard of her.
The reaction of many people was, what a remarkable overnight success. We've been publishing her for 12 years. That was her fifth book. It didn't feel overnight at all. And I think that, you're right, it's venture capitalism. Those earlier books were not successful. We believed in her. Everyone here has had the experience of persisting with an author and believing in that author and, just investing continually, emotionally, mentally,
financially because it's worth it. Yeah, and then sometimes it pays off. Most of the time it doesn't. It's heartbreak. Yeah, most of the time, but a lot of the time, some of the time it does pay off and sort of makes it worthwhile.
Yeah, you know, every single book that these folks publish is a book that they really, really believe in. It's a lot of work to publish these books. So they never publish mediocre books, right? Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. Yeah. I mean, we acquire what we love.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add one thing to that, just speaking about how things of the landscape of what media looks like has changed. And one thing that we do at Riverhead is we perpetually publish books. So it used to be more that you might have a book that goes out and you know, sometimes this is true still, but that you have a few weeks when attention is being paid to that book. But we believe that a book exists throughout the rest of its life, which is forever. And so we're perpetually publishing people. So if something comes up that seems to speak to that book, then we'll try to arrange interviews for the author or have them talk about the book or use social media channels to have them discuss it. You know, I'm still arranging interviews for authors whose books came out years ago. And that's because we invest in an author's career as a whole and that we're publishing authors, not books. I mean, we're publishing the book specifically to many different types of audiences, but we're continuing on with that author and again over the course of the book's life. So perpetual publishing is something that feels different to me because there are more opportunities than there might have been 10 or 15 years ago.
And these are the kind of publishers you want.
Thank you. These
are
the kind of publishers you
want to
read, too.
Yeah. Question right here.
If you don't mind me going back to the issue of literary versus genre, most recently, I think one of the most successful stories of the boundaries between literary and genre have been so successfully blurred, The Sympathizer by Viet Wynn.
Yeah.
A lot of critics agreed that if it wasn't for the beauty of language in that book would have been classified as a thriller. Do you agree that, considering sort of like the decaying of language that's happening now, and I happen to be on the side that yes, it is undergoing a kind of decay, do you think that it boils down to a matter of how good the language is of a literary novel as opposed to a mystery or a romance?
Right, so this is a question about, again, looking at that maybe even fuzzy line between genre fiction and literary fiction, and using the example of The Sympathizer as a book. Right, that's a book that, if not for its spectacular language, might have been considered a thriller, a standard genre. And so in that case, it was the level of the language that elevated it, let's say, to literary fiction. And I think one could come up with different ways that other books that, you know, were Paul Ostrog and Easy, that might be genre fiction if not for other things. In his case, less language, I think, than maybe philosophical issues.
Exactly.
Right? So there are various ways that literary fiction can use genre. And there are sometimes maybe genre writers who maybe inadvertently write a piece of literary fiction, depending on who's reviewing the book.
I don't think language is the key necessarily. I think that every good book has its own language. And the real question is, has the author brought the right language to the work so that it is elevated to the degree it needs to be? I think each story has its own place.
When it comes to genre literary, maybe it's just, is there something about that book that goes beyond the expectations of that genre?
And in that case, it would be the prose.
In this case, the prose, but it could be form, it could be philosophical issues, it could be some other kind of complexity or not. Or it could be even a mixing of standard genres. There are all kinds of ways to do it. Or the empathy quotient of the book, which might be mysteriously created by the writer.
I published The Known World, which some you could say is a historical novel set in Virginia, 1853. Certainly language, but also the empathy that he endowed every character. It's about slavery, but there was no pure good, no pure evil. The complexity of the human condition, it sounds like such a cliche, but I think all of those things have to factor in, first and foremost.
Global.
Yeah.
Global empathy, hashtag.
Let's go right here, and then we'll go way back there. Well, I didn't want. Yeah, the question was that I had talked about current trends not always being new trends.
That's what
Yeah, and that sometimes they're more traditional things. And I think I was partly alluding to the fact that we assumed, 5 years ago even, that by now everyone would only be reading digitally. That seemed obvious. Is everyone only reading digitally now? You know the answer.
I want to speak to that very specifically in terms of what Michael brought up and then what Katie seconded. In terms of the design of books and books as objects and smaller presses with wonderful specific design sensibilities that they take advantage of and magnify through social media. And to me, that speaks back to New Directions or Early Grove Press and their very specific aesthetics. And this ties in, for me, to what I noticed 2 weeks ago at the Winter Institute, which is a gathering of booksellers across the country. So many under 40 professionals opening bookstores, trying to buy bookstores, trying to start bookstores. And to me, though that's not specifically publishing, that is a heartening trend. And it ties into the beauty of the book as an object, and who's buying those books as physical objects. And so to me, there's something going on there. That I'm very optimistic about. I don't know. It's mainly anecdotal.
Well, I can give you a piece of data. Just speaking only from small press distribution, we only sell print books. We a few years ago started to move into selling digital, and then we stopped. And since then, our sales have gone up dramatically every year. This year, they are up 28% over last year, which I think is ahead of the larger industry curve, I'm not really sure, but you know, we sell to more focused audiences. We sell a lot of books that have print runs of 250 to 1,000, and but we're selling more percentage-wise of each of those print runs than we were a couple of years ago. That is thrilling. You know, the Codex, the bound book, is a very resilient little object. It still works. It's kind of amazing. Since we moved from scrolls to, you know, the Codex or the bound book. Not much change, really. Really not much change over a long period of time.
It is possibly a perfect technology.
Yeah, it really is. You never have to charge it. You know, it's great. That said, I read a lot digitally. I love it. So I buy even more print books. It's another way for me to consume books, and it is for many of us. It's not as we thought it would be a substitute. It's turned out to be another way to read. I will say for publishers, it's a challenge. Maybe it's fair to say, I know for small ones, because you have to publish in yet another way. And so it provides even more work and more challenges for publishers. Good ones, but it does. We had a question way back there. Yeah,
no, go ahead.
So I'm not sure I heard all about it. The question was about literary fiction gaining traction or not in digital books.
Yeah.
Right, I know that. And so then extending to audiobooks, has there been a growth in audiobooks for literary fiction? Anyone could maybe answer that.
I think the short answer is yes. I mean, the audiobook segment of the industry is growing quite rapidly. And we know that the digital books are flattening out, certainly when it comes to literary fiction. That's tougher, I guess. And I tend to think, because I work in publishing, that it's the cleverness of the people who are doing it, who are publishing those things. And I think there's greater curation in audiobooks now. The audiobook publishers have identified this as a growing sector, so the people that are reading the books are exceptional.
Do you think it might be that we live in lives now where we're frequently forced to multitask, so it's a way to be able to read while doing something else?
Yeah, sure. I think there are all of those external factors
Streaming has helped tremendously, too. I mean, the fact that it no longer is the fact that you're no longer on a CD or, God knows, a cassette tape, streaming is very helpful, I think, in the rise of the radio that we've seen recently. But it's another way that video did not kill the radio. So
that's true. We are still, 8-track tapes could be coming back. On that... we've come to the end of our time. So on that hopeful note, people are actually reading in many ways more, despite the awful statistics we sometimes hear about. Many people are, in fact, reading more, so that's great. We see more bookstores. There are more people caring about this. They might be more focused, and it's our jobs to get out there and encourage others to love what we love as well. Thank you, panelists, so much for being here. Thank you all for coming.